We spent the rest of the afternoon in an azaria. Alma did some translating. We talked to some children who gathered around us, pointing at our weapons, waving to us. Some of them imitated us, walking the way they thought we walked. I guess we looked funny to them in our desert camouflage, Kevlar helmets, and mall vests. Were they so used to the killing that they could go on with their lives so easily? Did the wailing of the woman for her grandson seem too familiar to them? They were only kids, for God's sake. The children either wore American-type clothes or long shirts that came down to their ankles. Sim spoke to me in Arabic. I forced smiles, but my mind was in chaos. The sight of the dead boy had scared me, as had the walking away from him. I looked over at the small crowd of Iraqis gathered around the body. They were wrapping him in cloth. Some 3 Ardead guys came over to where I was standing with some candy and started passing it out. They're like all kids, the guy next to me, a stocky sergeant with a southern accent, said. He offered me the box. Yeah. I took the box. You get used to the killing. He said the words softly. It don't help much at night when you're trying to sleep, but you get used to it. March 25, 2003. Dear Uncle Richie, I'm writing this letter out. I probably won't mail it. I probably won't save it either. Today I saw a stranger die. I saw what the M16S could do. I don't know why the kid started to run. Maybe he was afraid. But what happened was that he was killed, and we left him lying on the ground. At first I was really sad, depressed. Then I felt myself trying to shut it out. I started by telling myself that he was probably one of the guys who wanted to kill Americans, but that was a dead-end street. It just didn't work. What works is to put it outside of you. To let it be not part of who you are. I know I won't ever be able to talk about it. I wonder if that is the reason you never talked about anything that happened in Vietnam. On the way back to our base I saw that Jonesy's hand was shaking. Nothing else, just his hand. I thought about putting my hand on his, but I didn't. None of us in First Squad talked about what had happened. The medical truck was all goodness. So were the medics who deal with civil affairs. They put out white tables and took out boxes of supplies. All the Iraqis recognized what was going on and started edging forward. You know what they have over here that they don't have at home? Marla asked me as she leaned against the fender of the Humvee. Her hip was touching mine. Arabs. Lame people, she answered. Most of them look all right, but you see a lot of people with birth defects and things they would have taken care of in the States. She was right. There were more crippled people and blind people in Kuwait and Iraq than I had ever seen at home. For many of the Iraqis it would be the only medical treatment they'd ever get. The 2 guys and 2 women doing the medical stuff treated anything, from chest colds to rashes. It was weird. On one side of the square, there were people washing the ground where the kid was killed. On the other side our medics were looking at sourcing passing out antibiotics. And there were some Iraqis who just stood silently. The kids began to get over their shyness once they saw adults talking to the medical people. They surrounded us, pulling at our gear, asking for candy, sometimes just trying to touch us. One kid had on a Derek Jeter Yankees t-shirt. I like that. I kept my eyes away from the house we had searched. Over and over I told myself that the kid had used the rocket launcher, that he had tried to kill Americans. Maybe he even had already killed Americans, and he was the enemy. In a way I was cool with that. In my head I could deal with his being dead. But it had all happened so quickly. One moment he was alive and he was scared, as I was scared with him and for him. And then he was dead. I had never been that close to anyone who was killed. I had heard the boy talking, had seen his dark eyes darting around the room. Then I saw his body jerking in the dusty street, as if he had already been separated from it. I wanted not to think. Marla was back up in the gunner's turret and I headed back to the Humvee. Yo, Marla, how you doing? I asked. If you see a bus schedule for Dix Hills, Long Island, save it for me, she said. I'm ready to leave this mother. Tell me about it. We weren't going home, of course. We were still wandering northward toward Baghdad. We weren't at the front of the action and I was glad of that, but there was enough going on where we were to keep us on our toes. Who's supposed to be the bad guys here? Jonesy asked as he slipped behind the wheel of the Humvee. We got people standing around looking like civilians 1 minute and then the next they're pulling heat from their closets. What I wanted, more than anything else, was to go to bed. I felt more tired than I could imagine, as if my very bones were drained. Of Merrill. Captain Coles came over and said that we were changing direction. He seemed jumpy too. Darcy was with him. Where are we going? Jonesy asked. The 240H medical called asking for some help south of Najaf, Coles said. That's about 100 and some miles northeast of here. There was some heavy fighting and the infantry suffered a number of wounded and a half dozen Kias. Their medical unit is dealing with the infantry and the worst of the wounded Iraqis. They want us to deal with some of the minor wounds of the Iraqis. We going to do it? I asked, instantly knowing that we would. Colt looked at me, then pivoted sharply and walked away. The medical team attached to us consisted of 2 physician's assistants, 1 male and 1 female, and 2 technicians. They seemed okay, dedicated really, and they worked well with the Iraqi women and kids. They hauled along a trailer behind their Humvee, and I watched as they loaded up. We're moving too fast, Marla said. How the heck can we fly past these villages and just leave them as if they're not Iraqis and we're not invading their country? I bet this all looks good on paper, Jonesy said. I asked Marla if she wanted me to take a turn on the squad gun. Don't get careless, she answered. She took a drink from her water bottle and swallowed hard. My throat was dry too. The water was warm but it felt good in my mouth as I settled down behind the machine gun. I shook my shoulders to loosen up. I wasn't afraid when we were moving. It was a different feeling when we were out of the vehicle and roaming around the villages. Second squad, with Ahmed along to interpret, was going to lead the way with the medical team next, and then us. The whole route was supposed to be under control of the 3RD. I could only hope it was. Our little convoy of 4 vehicles took off. Darcy popped up in the 2 squad gun position and waved. Jonesy measured the distance in time between vehicles and eased onto the open road. I felt vulnerable in the turret, as if every gun had an eye on the end of it that was looking for me. I felt ashamed of what I was thinking. I wanted my mind on the road and what was happening around me. I turned sideways, trying to see if anything was coming behind me. I kept the gun sights moving along the building lines. We passed 1 low building with tables and chairs and men eating and drinking. They pointed at us as we passed, and when I pointed the gun at them, one of them opened his shirt as if to dare me to fire at him. I reminded myself of my mission in Iraq. I was defending America from its enemies, removing weapons of mass destruction from Iraq, and building democracy. If the jerks drinking tea didn't appreciate that, I didn't care. We drove with as much speed as we could. I was really sorry that I had volunteered to relieve Marla on the squad gun because it was uncomfortable as anything I could imagine. My legs were aching as we drove north along the Euphrates River. The 3RD had set up roadblocks along the way and I was glad to see them. They had put MPs, military police, at some of the places on the roads. It was reassuring to know we were at least going in the right direction. Occasionally we hit traffic, mostly supply trucks headed in the same direction we were or empty trucks headed south to pick up more supplies. The traffic worried me because I didn't want to get separated from our convoy. I expected we would pull into a Najaf, find something to eat, and sit around for the rest of the night in whatever facilities they had set up. But as we approached the city, I knew that wasn't going to happen. The noise from the fighting was unbelievable. If you listened, you could tell what was firing. AK-47s, M-16s, mortars, tanks, grenades. All kinds of ways to die in a hurry. We're holding up here. Colt yelled into the radio. We pulled the Humvee off the road. We were less than a half mile from town. Black smoke billowed up above the buildings and then flattened out and drifted sharply to the east. Bursts of automatic fire came and went, as if there were some dialogue between them that nobody understood. In training I used to like the night exercises. We used tracer bullets along with our regular ammo and you could see them streaking across the darkness toward their targets. But here, so many miles from home, in the gathering darkness, the explosions were terrifying. From where I sat, I could sometimes feel the impact of a shell, feel the shock of an explosion as it traveled through the still night air. I was holding my breath. Beneath me, in the cab of the Humvee, the radio crackled. We were picking up the communications from the battlefield. Men spoke with a quiet urgency. Tracer fire crisscrossed the city. Brilliant flashes of light illuminated buildings for mere seconds before dying out. I could smell what seemed like oil burning and a sickly sweet odor I couldn't identify. Bertie. Marla pulled on my pants leg.
What?
If you go into town, bring back a sausage pizza and 2 Diet Cokes, she said. I don't think I'm going in any time soon, I said. You think they'll deliver? Coles confirmed it. He told us to hunker down and stay alert. And keep your body armor on. We stayed put all night, taking turns sleeping, or trying to sleep. Jonesy conked out first. Marla worked on eating an MRE in the dark. She said she could smell the whole meal, dry and cold, through the packing. Marla. You can't smell it through the packing, I said. What is it? I can even tell you what kind of cookies they have for dessert, she said. I don't believe you, I said. She shrugged me off and told me to stay alert. I asked her who made her the squad's mama and she laughed. It was a nice laugh. At 10 o'clock in the morning, 1000 hours military time, Captain Coles called to say we were moving out. Marla was outside of the Humvee stretching her legs and had to scramble back in. I'm back on the gun, she said. As we rolled toward the city we could still hear sporadic gunfire. There were lots of our guys around, and down the street a tank stood guard on the corner. Coles called back to us and asked if our map had street names and Jonesy told him that it didn't. I could hear Coles cursing into the radio. Contact left. Marla called out. I turned left and saw a green car speeding toward us. The Humvee came to a hard stop. I heard the squad guns as they sent bursts of fire toward the oncoming vehicle. The car skidded to a halt and fishtailed slightly. Their front wheels ended up on the sidewalk. The doors opened and a group of civilians climbed out, keeping their hands in sight. Watch him. Captain Coles' voice came over the radio. Contact right. Contact right. Sergeant Harris. Panic. We were situated at the end of a long street. On the left the car had stopped. On the right dark figures skirted along the shadows. The flash of the rocket launcher spread out in a puff and I could see the rocket trail headed toward the middle of the street. It hit two-thirds short and sent flame first in the air and then rolling toward us. I couldn't see anyone, but I knew where they had been and started firing. Somebody shot off some grenades and they exploded, lighting up the area they hit for the split second needed to produce eerie silhouettes. Whack. Whack. Bullets hit the side of the Humvee. I couldn't tell who was shooting at us, but I knew they were coming close. We sprayed the street in front of us and the nearby windows. There was an explosion behind us and the Humvee lifted off the ground for a second. Mortar, right corner. I looked toward the right corner and saw two figures. They were carrying a house fan on a stand, not a mortar. Silence. Check the buildings. Coles's voice was urgent and higher than usual. My eyes were everywhere, jerking around as I pointed my piece from area to area. Marla, you okay? I called to her. I think so. Her voice was whispery. You sure? Jonesy asked. I'm not shot, so I guess I'm okay, Marla said. We lit up the area and saw two bodies lying in the street on my side of the vehicle. The car that had been speeding toward us still rested with its wheels on the sidewalk. Everybody okay? Asked Captain Miller in the medical truck. Everybody checked in. When it was my turn, my voice cracked badly. One of the medics had a head injury from his vehicle being rocked by an explosion, but it didn't seem too serious. What do we do about them? A voice came over the radio. One of them is still alive out there. I see him moving. He was on my side of the street. Jonesy got back behind the wheel, backed the vehicle up, and moved slowly toward the guy. Marla. I'm on him. She said. Harris was out of his Humvee, moving toward the guy. He crouched low with his rifle ahead of him. I remembered Ahmedin was about to ask Captain Coles to get him to talk Arabic to the wounded man when the guy swung his arm up. There was a pistol in it. The gunman shot wildly, almost as if he wasn't trying to hit us, just making one last defiant statement. Harris shot him more times than necessary. The body had stopped moving with the first shot. Second squad policed the long end of the street, collecting some weapons from the smashed car. I watched them search the dead dudes. Yuck. We got back in what amounted to a little formation and headed on. The tension was unbelievable. I couldn't keep my head still. It was almost daybreak and every shadow looked as if it had a gun. Captain Coles put himself on intercom as he tried to contact the unit we were looking for. He gave our position and in minutes a Bradley appeared to pick us up and lead us to their medical setup. We reached a cafe being used as a makeshift hospital for wounded Iraqi civilians. The medics came out and I saw that Owens, who was with the medics, had a bandage on her forehead. A sergeant from the 3RD came over and asked if she was all right. Just a hell of a bump, she said. Then get your damn Kevlar back on, he said, and do it now. The medic shot him a dirty look, and then gingerly put the helmet over Owens's bandage. There were wounded civilians, men, women, and children, in the cafe. The worst off were on stretchers along the wall and our medical people looked at them. We were told to search everybody. The guys searched the males, and Marla and the female medics searched the women. They didn't have weapons. Only one person had been shot. All the others had either been burned or hit with shrapnel or flying debris. A thin brown man, bald on top, looked closest to dying but had no visible wounds except for a few spots of blood under his nose. An Iraqi who spoke English said that the man had been sitting on a folding chair. When a shell hit down the street and the shock of it had picked him up off his chair and thrown him against a wall. Some of the other wounds were terrible. An old man was lying in a corner on his back. He had a string of beads draped across his palm. His hand and the beads shook uncontrollably. The front of his robe was covered with more blood than anybody was supposed to lose. When the beads fell from his hand, I bent over, picked them up, held his wrist, and draped them over his fingers. The old man looked up at me. I don't know if he could see me clearly or not, but he looked. Bertie, give me a hand, Marla called. She had a little girl, maybe 8 or 9, whose leg was bloodied. We carried her over to the aid station our people had set up and laid her on the ground. The front of the little dress she was wearing, it might have been her nightgown, was covered with blood. Marla lifted it to see if the girl was hurt bad. She was. An angry wound seeped blood diagonally across her small chest. None of it was good. I didn't want to be connected with the wounds, or with the dying. It all looked so much better in the training films, when the figures were just silhouettes flickering across a screen. When it was all just a video game. But up close, the smell of blood was connected with real people. I knew that many of them wouldn't make it. They would be dead before the night came, or surely by the next morning. Then it was noon and somebody said that the 3RD was serving hot food down the street. There was still the sound of sporadic gunfire, but it seemed farther away. I looked for Marla and Jonesy and asked if they wanted to go get something to eat. Jonesy did, but Marla wanted to help the medics. I thought of staying too, but I went for breakfast instead. We lined up with the guys from the 3RD, had scrambled eggs and sausages. The military cooks were actually using a local Iraqi guy to help them. Me and Jonesy sat down and ate. We took some eggs and coffee back to Marla. Her face was pale with the strain of the work. She ate the eggs on the edge of a cot in which an Iraqi woman was lying. The woman, dressed in black, was facing the wall. She okay? I asked Marla. What do you think? She answered. The portable toilet facility stunk and the small cabin was filled with tiny flies that bit my butt, but it was the sounds of incoming mortars that shook me the most. Hey, man, you could be sitting under a tree and if the mortar hits you it's all over, Jonesy had said. At first I thought that I just didn't want to die with my pants down around my ankles. Then I realized that it was the noise, the constant booming, that just filled my guts with a trembling sensation. I knew if I heard the boom I was safe because whatever had exploded hadn't hit me. But it was the idea that at any moment it could be all over, that I could be dead or lying in the sand twisting in agony, that filled me with a terror that I hadn't known before. Terror. It wasn't just being scared. It was a feeling that was taking me over. I knew it, but I hoped no one else saw it. When I came out, I saw Jonesy drinking a bottle of water. He had his Kevlar pushed back and the water up to his lips. He held a thumb up to me as I approached. "How you doing?" I asked. "Keeping on, bro," he said. He pulled another bottle of water from his vest and handed it to me. "Captain Coles just got chewed out."
"Captain Coles?"
A thirded guy jumped all over him, "Man. Chewed him up one side and down the other. The guy seemed so pissed I thought he was gonna shoot him."
"What happened?"
"The water was cold and delicious. I poured some in my palm and wiped my face with it. Somebody said that we had to take prisoners up to PSYOP to be interviewed and the captain said we weren't messengers," Jonesy said. "I guess he was wrong. I didn't dig the PSYOP guys too much. The ones I had met thought that being in psychological operations meant that they were smarter than everybody else. They might have been, but they didn't have to act like it. I had seen the leaflets they dropped over Iraq and the ones they handed out wherever we went. Most were threats with English on one side and Arabic on the other. 'If you shoot at us, we'll kill you, and if you're friendly, we'll help you build a new nation,' that kind of thing. If it was up to me, I wouldn't be taking them no place," he said. "Not after that scene." He half lifted his empty water bottle to point to a place behind me. I looked to see what he was talking about and saw guys putting the bodies of dead soldiers into a truck. Four men were taking the dead, two soldiers to each body bag, past the others who were standing at attention. The bodies seemed light as they loaded the litters into the back of the truck. A heavy Iraqi woman, dressed all in black, glanced at the operation, then hurried down the street. In a narrow street, small brown kids stood against the walls and watched. I wondered what they were thinking. "It's tough to go down so far from home," I said. "My mom's couldn't take that," Jonesy said. "That would kill her faster than it would kill me." An image of my mom, sitting at her kitchen table in Harlem, flashed through my mind. If I were killed, she would cry, I knew. It would hurt her so much, and as I stood watching the ritual of gathering the dead, I felt sorry for her. I knew what Jonesy was saying, that the dying hurt everybody. I wondered what my father would think. Would he blame me for dying? Would he say I should have listened to him? I wanted to talk to him so bad. There wasn't anything special I had to say, just that I thought what he wanted for me was okay. Maybe that I loved him. I took out my pen and started to write a note to myself to tell my parents that I loved them. It was BS. The part about reminding myself. There were three prisoners. Second squad took two of them and we took one, an old man. He was nearly bald, with patches of woolly hair on the sides of his head turning white. He was the same color as me too. Thin, square-shouldered, slightly stooped, the old man looked too small to be considered dangerous. He was scared of us. He tried to smile but only showed a small row of bad teeth. Ahmed rode with us. Third squad took the point, we were next, and second squad followed us. "Stay close and stay in contact." Captain Coles was subdued. He had had his ass handed to him by the officer from the 3RD and it showed. We mounted up and moved out. I got the map coordinates for the FOB and went over them with Jonesy. He asked Marley if she wanted to drive and she said no. "I want to be up so I can see what's going on," she said. "And if I'm up there I don't have to make small talk with you dudes."
"Good."
Marla was coming back. The prisoners' hands were held together with plastic strips. The two prisoners in the other Humvee had cloths over their heads but ours didn't. "Hey, Ahmed, ask him why he was doing whatever he was doing," Jonesy said. Ahmed said something to the guy but there was no answer. Ahmed hit him in the forehead with the heel of his hand, snapping his head back, and the guy looked first startled, then angry.
My rifle was between my legs and I turned slightly so that it was pointed at him. The old man spoke in Arabic and I looked at Ahmed. Ahmed asked something and the guy answered. His voice was soft and he talked with his head down. I wanted him to speak louder even though I didn't understand Arabic.
What's he saying?
Jonesy asked. He's saying that he's been a good man all of his life, Ahmed replied. He's made his hajj and does God's will. He says he's an old man and doesn't know why we want to kill him.
Why are we taking him instead of some of the others?
Jonesy asked. Ahmed talked to the man again. This time his voice softened and I wondered what he was saying, because whatever it was changed Ahmed's attitude toward him. Ahmed had just rapped the old guy in the forehead, but now I could definitely hear a change in his voice. The man answered, then looked away out of the window. He was looking at a road he had probably traveled all of his life. Past familiar rocks, past a burned-out building, maybe even past people he knew. He says that the Americans found an AK-47 in his house, Ahmed translated. He said it was a Russian gun that he bought years ago to protect himself. He says he wanted to protect himself from robbers, and he didn't expect Americans to come to kill him.
Tell him we didn't come to kill him, I said.
That we're trying to build a democracy over here.
You bombed my village, the old man, his head down, replied slowly in English.
First you shoot into my house, then you come to the door.
Where you learn to speak English?
Jonesy asked. I drove a cab in London for 12 years, answered the old man. When I had enough money to buy a house for my family, I came back to my country.
You're going to be all right, Jonesy said.
We don't hurt our prisoners.
My house had holes in the walls, the old man said.
I am away from my family.
Is this all right?
Your ass could be dead, said Jonesy.
We drove the next miles in silence. It was all pretty confusing.
We had been attacked.
The guys who had fired on us didn't know us, and we didn't know them.
I thought of them getting up in the morning and having their breakfast.
Perhaps they had talked about the war.
Perhaps they had imagined themselves fighting heroically against us.
Now they were dead and the meaning of it was somewhere in the thin smoke that rose over the buildings.
There were lots of vehicles on the road, Bradleys, big trucks, all headed north.
We passed Iraqis going about their business on the highway.
Some of them just stood by the side of the road, watching us.
There was a man and a boy on a cart piled high with old furniture, being pulled by a donkey.
We passed a tank that had a sign on its side, John 13:15.
I asked Jonesy what it meant.
He didn't know.
We reached a command post set up in a private house.
An MP took the old man from us and put a hood over his head before leading him away.
I hope they were going to treat him gently.
The 3RD, according to Captain Coles, was headed towards Jalil Airport, which was southeast of us.
Yo, Captain, is the 3rd leaving a couple of companies when they take over a place to make sure it stays safe?
Jonesy asked.
They're moving so fast they're going to have one dude left when they reach Baghdad.
That's the point, Captain Coles said.
Hit hard and hit fast.
Yeah, all that's good on paper, sir, Jonesy said.
But one time I hit a guy hard and fast and knocked his tooth out.
Then he commenced to kick my butt long enough for him to have to take a lunch break.
What I thought was bothering Jonesy, and what was definitely messing with my mind, was that it was hard to tell who the enemy was, and with our soldiers moving from place to place so quickly, it was getting hard to tell where our friends were too.
We picked up a new intelligence officer, Captain Phil Nelson, and 2 other intelligence types. We were supposed to go from the FOB, which was nothing but a few tents in the sand, to a mining area about 15 to 20 miles away.
Is this a hot zone?
Captain Cole stood close to Nelson as he spoke.
That's what we're going to find out, Captain Nelson said. He was short with a huge round head and big blue eyes that made him look like a baby in uniform.
This place has been inspected by the United Nations 100 times, but what I'm hoping for is that we can find some civilians who can give us a feel for the area, let us know if they're glad we're knocking over Saddam.
Any friendlies there now?
Cole asked.
A marine detachment, Nelson said.
They're telling us it's safe for us to go in, you're looking for civilians.
Do you speak Iraqi?
I speak Arabic, Nelson said, looking about as white as a human being could look. The intelligence guys supposedly knew where they were going and would lead the way with second squad. Captain Coles rode with us. Inside the Humvee, the captain was mumbling to himself. Something we should know? Jonesy asked. The chain of command is getting weak, Coles said. If you listen to the air traffic, you hear a lot of people trying to find out where their units are. I thought they were hitting fast and hard. Marla chimed in. If you're in a fight and you're winning, it's fine, Captain Coles said. But if something looks fishy and you need some backup in a hurry, it would be good to know where the cavalry is. And the way I figure it, you can never tell when you're going to need some backup in a hurry, I said. This reminds me of when they started a happy hour in a bar in my hometown, Jonesy said. It was a colored bar and they ain't never had a happy hour. Some folks thought they was gonna get free drinks. When they found out that they had to buy a drink to get a free one, they got to fighting and tore the place up. That's what's happening over here. They don't know if they should be getting happy or tearing us up. Marla was on the squad gun and I tapped her knee to get her attention as Jonesy pulled the Humvee out onto the road. I thought she might be tired. She kicked me with the back of her heel. Yo, Marla, I'm a friendly. I called to her. Mess with my leg again and I'll shoot you through the top of your head, she answered. Yo, Jonesy, is Marla weird or what? I asked. Hey, man, we all weird, Jonesy said. Or do you always do drive-bys in the name of democracy? We were going south again to meet up with a company from the 3RD. Captain Coles had the GPS system going and was comparing the coordinates on the screen with our maps. That made me feel a little better because there weren't any map landmarks that I recognized. There were some American military trucks on the road, mostly supply units, and a few British units. There were Iraqi vehicles as well, older trucks and an occasional overcrowded bus. Captain Coles started talking about what was probably going on in his hometown and we figured out that the time difference was 8 hours. It's 3 in the afternoon here and back home they're just getting up, he said. Contact ahead, they're moving to one side. Marla's voice was crisp, hard. I felt myself tensing. For a moment I closed my eyes, then realized what I was doing, and opened them again. I felt my hand sweating and wiped it on my pants leg. Please, God, don't let me do anything stupid. What do you think? Captain Coles asked. The first two Humvees had already passed an old wagon. Its right side was broken down and it leaned precariously. One of the Iraqis was unhitching the two old mules that had been pulling it, while two other men argued with each other. They don't look like hostiles, sir, I said. Keep moving, Jonesy, Cole said. Jonesy had slowed to a crawl, and started edging along the left side of the road when the wheel started slipping. There were a number of curses as the Humvee slid along the shoulder and into the marshy area. Jonesy revved up the engine and tried to get us out. Nothing. The other Humvees slowed when they saw us stop. Coles got on the radio and told them what was going on. The Humvee in front of us stopped 60 yards down the road and second squad backed up for security behind us. Keep your eyes open, Marla, Jonesy said. Jonesy frantically spun the wheels, but the Humvee just slid deeper into the marsh. Coles got off the radio and started cursing again. He was really good at it too. Nobody's got a tow chain, he said. If they try to push us out, we'll all be stuck here. I got out and sank into a foot of warm, stinky mud. It smelled like human waste. I wanted to gag. I slogged my way up to the road until I was on solid ground. Captain Coles came out next. Jonesy and Marla followed, sinking thigh deep in the slop. What the hell are we going to do? Jonesy asked. No way I'm walking back. We'd have to destroy the vehicle if we left it, Captain Cole said. Let me try to get it out. Keep an eye on our guests. There were 3 Iraqi men, 2 young guys and an older man. They were looking under the wagon and pointing. Captain Coles got into the Humvee, turned on the engine, and we watched as the back end of it slipped even farther. The Iraqi men started talking to one another and one of them climbed onto the wagon. Jonesy and I had our M16s ready and I stepped a few feet away from him. The Iraqi that had climbed into the wagon, one of the younger guys, came out with a rope. He started our way. None of us spoke Arabic, so we had to figure out that he meant to tie a rope to the Humvee and pull it out of the marsh. We could call back to the base and get another vehicle out here with towing equipment in a half hour or so, I said. Or whoever is watching us could get a vehicle of Arabs over here in 5 or 10 minutes, Jonesy said. We'd be sitting ducks on foot. There's nothing to get behind. I smiled at the Iraqis, or at least pushed my face forward into what I hoped looked like a smile, and reached for the rope. The Iraqi held his hands up and then started toward the Humvee. The other young guy went out into the goo with them and I remembered the box of grenades we had left behind in the Humvee. Wonderful. The two men left their sandals on the road, lifted their long shirts, and waded through the mud to the back of the Humvee. They found the tow hook and tied the rope to it, and then held the rope high while they came back onto the road. Then the oldest Iraqi went and got the mules. Bertie, this is embarrassing, Marla said as the guy tied the rope around the mule's halter. Gah! He yelled. The mules started to pull. Jonesy got behind the wheel and started the engine. A few more Iraqis, two older guys, and a woman with three children stopped to look. One of the men was hollering out something and trying to show Jonesy which way to turn the wheel. It took 15 minutes before the Humvee cleared the mud. We thanked the Iraqis and offered them $10 in American money, but they turned it down. There was a lot of smiling and bowing and I could see that the Iraqis were pleased with themselves. Here we were, the conquering heroes stuck in the mud, and here they were, rescuing us. Back in the Humvee we were very embarrassed and smelled like dog crap. Marla cleaned her hands with disinfectant gel and wiped them off on me. The Iraqis cheered us as we started off. We reached Shuyik, the place we were supposed to be, and found the other squads. Sergeant Harris came over and, as soon as he got a whiff of us, stopped and backed off two steps. Man, y'all smell bad. Shut up, Sergeant, Captain Cole snapped. He was trying to wipe the bottom of his fatigues off with hand wipes. Harris went back to the other squads and soon they were all around us, offering helpful comments about personal hygiene. Jean Darcy asked us if we had some kind of secret weapon. We're in the same unit, so if you got something good you should share it, she said. I think you're like clouding the enemy's mind or something with that stench. Marla blamed the whole thing on Jonesy. I can't handle the turret, lead the way, and drive at the same time, she said. You could at least change them when they make poo-poo in the pants, Jean said. Captain Coles tried to smile but couldn't. We were at the Shuyik site for an hour, while the intelligence guys talked to some locals. I found out they were looking for weapons of mass destruction and this was one of the suspected sites. They didn't find any weapons of mass destruction, but they did find a crate of American cigarettes. On the way back to the base the stink got worse and Captain Coles said we had better wash good. Maybe even get antibiotics or something, he said. God only knows what we were wading through. When we hooked up with the guys from the 3RD we found it was the signal detachment. They had trucks full of communication gear as well as dozens of portable generators. We were given a choice of what we could do. We could go back to the bivouac area that the headquarters element of the 3RD had set up outside of Anas area that night, or the first thing in the morning. None of us could stand the smell any longer so we decided to stay the night. Field showers are usually cold but the water had been warmed enough by the sun to make these all right. I washed and thought about what my mom would have said if she had seen us being pulled out of the marsh. I was sure she would have laughed. Yo, Bertie, you know all of this part of the world is in the Bible? Jonesy asked. If you say so. I was on the ground with my gear under my head. You go to church back home? He asked. Sometimes. You? My father's a minister, he said. But I don't go. Jonesy had a portable radio and turned it on. He put it on his chest but was soon asleep and the radio fell off. When he rolled over on it, I thought he would wake up. He didn't. It had been that kind of a day. April 4, 2003, Dear Dad and Mom, things are going well here. We have met very little resistance. The infantry guys and the Marines are catching it a little hot. My unit is still cool. I think we are helping the Iraqis, But even more than that, I think we are showing them that Americans are good people, and that we don't want to hurt them. Iraq is weird, kind of an odd mix with old stuff and new. Some of the cities look as if everything was built a few months ago, but other places could be directly out of the Old Testament. I guess that sounds silly because I don't know what the world looked like during the Old Testament, but it's what I imagine. We did have some people take a few shots at us, but nobody in our unit was injured. When the Iraqis shoot at Americans, there is a terrible price for them to pay because what we have to shoot back with is overwhelming. The only problem is that it is hard to know who the bad guys are or if there are really any bad guys. I don't know what it will be like later on. It depends, I guess. If they respect us and accept democracy, then everything will turn out all right. I heard a guy from one of the infantry units say that this is a camel tank war. They have the camels and we have the tanks. The whole thing should be over soon, which is good. I will try to get copies of pictures to send to you. There are reporters everywhere. They are allowed to come along on the missions and even film in combat zones. They let the Arabic news people come along too. There are a lot of ways of looking at what is happening over here, one guess. Mom, Dad, I love you both very much and miss you as well. Your son, Robin. P.S. This girl in our squad, Marla Kennedy from Long Island, calls me Birdie, and now everyone is calling me Birdie. I don't mind, though. April 12, 2003, Dear Uncle Richie, it's over. I didn't think I would be so relieved, but I am. Everybody here is celebrating. We rolled into Baghdad early this morning and people on the street were waving to us. Whoa. It's like winning the Super Bowl or something. We picked up a Marine escort and they asked us if we wanted to go to Ferdows Square, which is like the main square in Baghdad, I guess. We said yes, of course, and they took us to where the statue of Saddam was torn down. We're bunking down in an office building. It had air conditioning before the war, but the electrical system is down big time. Jonesy found something that looks like a guitar, but an Iraqi called it an out. Jonesy is trying to play the blues on it. We're all kind of relaxed. There were casualties, but none as bad as what I thought might happen. I think the 4th Marines took the most hits. There is talk that they had more guys killed than the papers or television mentioned. Some guys from the 4th came here to pick up quick clot bandages. They said it wasn't for them, but for some of the Kurdish fighters from the north. To tell the truth, you can't tell the players over here without a scorecard. There are Iraqis all over the place, it is their city and everything, but who knows what they are thinking. I asked Ahmed if the Iraqis are really glad we're here and kicked out Saddam. He said he couldn't tell because they were afraid of him. Him and us too. I guess. I think they were glad to see us. Otherwise wouldn't they have fought more? I don't know how many Iraqis were killed or wounded. They don't count them except in the after-action reports. And then I think it's more of a guess than anything because a guy in the 3RD said that the Iraqis always drag away their bodies. I know they could have fought more because we are finding huge amounts of shells, ammo, and stuff. Some of it's old and nobody is paying much attention to it, but there's tons of the stuff around. There's looting going on too. Guys with wheelbarrows piled high with furniture, office machines, and anything else that isn't nailed down. Anyway, I'm sure everybody at home is glad the war is over. Yesterday, or the day before, I couldn't tell, the Iraqi 5A Corps formally surrendered. There are rumors that we could be going home within 2 weeks. I think we'll have to serve a full 6 months before they start rotating us back. I just hope they start counting the 6 months from the time we first landed in Kuwait. I wanted to write to Dad and tell him about the war being over, but he is still acting sour about me being in the army. I received the letter Mom wrote and he added a note that only said that he was glad I was safe. I bet Mom told him to add that. It's funny, but one of the reasons I'm glad that I didn't get killed or wounded or anything was that I didn't want Dad to say I told you so. Goodbye for now, Robin, P.S. Another rumor is that they have found a mountain of poison gas canisters and some other suspicious material. I guess those are the weapons of mass destruction that everyone was talking about. Though, Captain Coles. Jonesy spotted Coles coming down the wide lane behind the main buildings. Captain Coles turned in our direction and then headed toward us. He had a smile on his face and I knew that he understood how pissed we were. We were at some Iraqi military school not far from Rashid Airport. This school was modern and only had a little damage from the invasion. But they had brought in porta potties and lined them up in the school's courtyard and our first squad was painting them. The other CA squads were off except for a little work they were doing in the sleeping area because they were going to be on patrol in the evening. Jonesy, you're doing a good job, Cole said.
Sir, I don't want to be doing no good job, Jonesy said. I'm supposed to be a warrior, not painting out houses.
They're inspecting the sewer system for hidden weapons and...